Blog Talk Radio.
Cannot play with them. Cannot win with them. Cannot coach with them. Can't do it. I want winners.
A new record, Michael Strahan. 22 and a half sacks. Breaks the bar held by Mark Gatto.
Just put your name on it. That's all I say. Be a man or a woman. Put your name on it.
Santonio with a touchdown. Santonio home. I don't know how he did it.
I'm raising the ante. Anybody wants in, get in. Anybody wants out, get out.
Devin Hester, you are ridiculous.
That's got to be one of those top 10 plays on SportsCenter YouTube.
Stay calm. Let's keep our composure.
A lot of time, patience.
Good skill stuff. You're never too old for skill.
It's early April. The sports world is buzzing from all corners. And today, you get the essentials. You already know what it is. It's New York Sports 30, baby. Boom. Welcome to it. Welcome to it. To New York Sports 30, presented by H4 TV and the Sports Journal. And I just want to say one thing real quick as I'm starting here. You know, I'm not able to do as many shows or as much work for the Sports Journal, especially the online portion, as I would like. A lot of things going on, school, work, things like that. And my producer slash, you know, manager, agent, CEO guy, that's Marcus Von Legend, the legend himself, still allows me to come do the show whenever I can, and we are keeping it once a week. It allows me to contribute whenever I can, because he understands that at the time, there are a lot of things going on. So I appreciate him more than anything. I had to give him a little on-air love, even if there's only a dozen people listening, including him. But I do appreciate it, Marcus. I'm Brian Sousa, coming at you from the concrete jungle of Queens. Enjoying my favorite half hour of the week. I'm here to give you the scoop on the New York sports scene and a little bit beyond. Today we're going to do our top stories, Chris Mullin back to St. John's. And we've got some Final Four in there. It's set. I'm proud to say that one of my brackets has the four Final Four teams in it. Although it wasn't maybe the most difficult thing to pick, for some reasons it was. It was kind of difficult. And we're going to do a little talking about these New York baseball teams as the season gets started on Monday, Mets and Yankees. And where I'm going to start the top story. The top story is royalty returns home for the Johnnies. Chris Mullin, the Wooden Award winner, three-time Big East Player of the Year, Final Four, 16-year pro career. He's got his number 17 retired by the Golden State Warriors, five-time NBA All-Star, and an original member of the Dream Team, which, in case you didn't know, not that many guys can say they're members of. So Chris Mullin's resume speaks for itself in terms of basketball. Now, his coaching resume is completely blank. And that was the thing. That was the thing where the detractors and the critics of this move, that's where they pointed their fingers. This guy's never coached before. That's true. It is true. There is that natural X's and O's concern that comes with the inexperience factor. But I guess that's where a solid staff comes into play. Talking about Rorson from Kentucky, who's a friend of Mullins, who's a great recruiter for Calipari, and that would be a big get for St. John's. We don't know about a lot of the specifics about the entire coaching staff, but we do know a few things. We know that Butts will be in the seats and that the alumni who preferred Mullin are happy with the choice and that money's going to be flushed into this program to maybe further renovate Carnesecca Arena or be able to pay for recruiting. But when you look at recruiting, it wasn't really St. John's problem. That wasn't even Steve Lavin's problem. The group that just left, that included D'Angelo Harrison and Phil Green, I believe Jakar Sampson might have been involved in that group either also, but he was gone already. You know, that was a top three recruiting class in the country. So it seems that X's and O's were the problem. I don't see recruiting being as big of an issue as people think. There's no reason to think that with Chris Mullin's cachet, which he does bring cachet no matter how long ago he played. He's one of the 50 greatest players ever, a Hall of Famer. Their cachet comes with that when he walks into a room, when he walks into a living room. And not just my living room, because we're Johnny's fans and I got his jersey in the closet. Prospective players' living rooms. High school kids' living rooms who maybe didn't get to see him play, but his dad, that their dad did. There's something to be said for that still. There's no reason to think that the cachet and the basketball prowess can't be built on in the recruitment area with a, you know, stay-at-home like I did approach. And in addition to that, Mullen knows the AAU coaches. He made the wisecracks about at his press conference about knowing the back ways into the gyms, knowing the janitors. And, you know, he makes light of it, but it's funny. He does it in a funny way, but it's true. You have to know these coaches. You have to know the guys who run these basketball leagues. And so that's for recruiting guys to stay home. And that's for recruiting guys in general. That's where his resume comes into play. Because his basketball acumen challenged. He's a mad scientist of basketball. The guy used to take the train up to Ed Pinckney's neighborhood, and Ed Pinckney would take the train down to his neighborhood. These guys lived basketball. And that's why the Big East was when it was the Big East. That's why. Guys like that. Mullen was 3-time Big East Player of the Year when the Big East was the SEC of football, basically. And being a coach is completely different than being a player. There is a certain level of unknown to it. But what St. John's wanted to do was restore relevance to the program, and that's exactly what they're doing. You can't say that they're not, and that's exactly what they're doing. And if you're a St. John's fan, there's many reasons to be optimistic. There are some things that have to be answered that you won't figure out just yet. Can he coach? I don't know. Can he be a leader of young men in that sort of uniform way, developing them as men and basketball players? Well, his coaching hero, Lou Carnesecca, did. And he even mentioned that that's who he aims to emulate a little bit. That's not a bad guy to emulate. And not a bad guy to have, you know, there to speak to at any time you need it. So I don't know. But there is reason for St. John's fans to be optimistic and to be happy about the royalty returning home. See, I used the title at the beginning and at the end. But the college basketball season's ending, and we'll get to the Final Four and take a call on it. But what's just beginning is baseball season for the Mets, for the Yankees, right after this ridiculous commercial break. Now I'm here. Now I'm here. Now I'm there. Show if you can't take a little break with Queen right in the middle of it. It says commercial break music, I just play it. We use that for our hockey show. The guy I had on with me absolutely loved it. He adored the fact that Queen came on. If I had the energy, I'd be switching that up every so often, and I will. And I will. The theme music too, although the instrumental to Diddy's Bad Boy for Life, in my opinion, is that's hard. That's a hard hook to have right there in the beginning and end of your show. But we're going to move on topics-wise. Baseball. The New York Yankees. Now, this season on the surface is important because, well, the Yankees could be missing the playoffs for the third season in a row. And we all know in the last 25 years how few times the Yankees have missed the playoffs. They made the playoffs every year except one up until this little stretch. So, you know, Tanaka looks like the key to all of this. You know, Tanaka opted not to have the Tommy John surgery. I would have done it. And we'll get to that in a second. But he looks like the key to all this, having your ace back, just like the way Matt Harvey is such a huge key for the Mets. But when you look back to last year, the Tanaka injury, the Sabathia injury, started this domino effect of four-fifths of the Yankee rotation was lost due to injury. But they managed to hang in there with the McCarthys and the Shane Greens and the Chase Whitleys and the Chris Capuanos. Even though it was pitching from the depth starters, pitching, nonetheless, wasn't the Yankee problem, even though their stars weren't throwing the ball. So I don't think that pitching, even though Tanaka's health is going to be Tanaka's health is a black cloud that I think hangs over the Yankees. I hate to eat side so easily with the consensus, but that's why I have a hard time figuring that Tanaka can make it through the next 6 years without needing the surgery. You know, your best case scenario is that, what, he's Adam Wainwright. He can hold it off for a couple of years, but he still has to have it, and then when he comes back, he's just as strong as he was before. That's what you hope. I'd like to think that Adam Wainwright was the exception to that, not the actual rule. I don't know. But it's hard to imagine that a partial tear won't worsen with all the stress on his elbow. And from the start, I would have had him get the surgery. ESPN New York Yankees reporter Wally Matthews said right in the from the very beginning, I'd get this done. And a lot of fans were against it because you know what that means. The Mets fans just experienced this with Harvey in the beginning of 2013. I mean, he's gone for at least 12 months. It's tough. But I agreed with Wally then, and I'm glad I did because I still feel the same way. And a lot of baseball people, you're hearing guys like Pedro Martinez, other pitchers, doctors come out and think, this guy's not going to make it. And now this is a black cloud hanging over the Yankees that can erupt into a thunderstorm at about any moment. But even with all of that, this is still about the Yankee bats. It's still about the bats because the Yankees hung in there with a backup rotation, basically. Not saying that that would happen again if they were decimated by injuries up front. But, you know, having those guys fill in really shed light on the fact that it was the bats. And it's going to be this season, 2015, where we judge how successful or not the 2014 offseason was, where the Yankees spent $500 million on the likes of Ellsbury, McCann, Beltran. I expect Ellsbury to be consistent, playing the outfield, hitting up near the top, along with Brett Gardner. But, you know, McCann can't be hitting 220. And Beltran's injuries make him a little bit of a wild card. You'd like to think that he can hang in there for more at-bats than he did last year. He's the only non-plus defender, really, in the Yankee starting lineup. But that's really only because his health has deteriorated. We saw with the Mets, he was one of the best defenders in the league. Still one of the best base stealers when it comes to the stolen bases, that by percentage. He still is, but it's everything's a question mark. It reminds you of the Mets a little bit, but it's different because every guy's a health thing. Teixeira, A-Rod. These are huge health concerns. How much can you really expect from Chase Headley? So, you know, you can talk about the pitching and you can talk about Tanaka all you want, but really, this is about the bats. This is about whether the Yankees are going to be able to score enough runs. They play in a small enough ballpark, they should be able to. But your big guys got to come through for you, and they got to be in the lineup more times than not. And that's where we're going to see whether or not Teixeira can stay in the lineup, whether or not McCann can hit for a decent average. And it's just so up in the air. But because of those injuries, you could also take the opposite side of my point and say, well, then even more, all the more reason why you need the pitching. Yeah, that's true. But this lineup didn't hit last year. They didn't hit last year, but they got the pitching. So that's why it's really nothing but question marks for the Yankees. And when you look at and when you look at the AL East, I see the Orioles winning it and the Yankees coming in. I think they could come in second. They could come in third. They have such a wide range of possibilities. Michael Kay, you know, Yankees announcer, has spoken so much about this. But I do see them winning anywhere from high 70s to low 90s. I'm going to guess mid 80s, just as a mean, because it's hard to tell. Injuries are the great equalizer for the Yankees. I don't know if they're going to, you know, make the playoffs. And what I want to talk about next is a little bit of the Mets and a little bit of Final Four action. But we're going to take our caller, friend of the program. He's one of the shakiest guys I know. This is Brian from Queens. Brian, how you doing today?
Hey, what's going on, Brian? How we doing?
Doing well, man. Thank you for calling. Now, you reached me at the perfect time before I even got to the Final Four. I was talking a little bit about the Mets here. You want to jump in on this little Mets chat with me?
Yeah, let's do it, baby.
All right, so now we know that you know, the expectations for 2015 seem to be playoffs or bust in terms of Terry Collins' job, in terms of what Sandy Alderson wants, and in terms of what we, the fans, think. And I've been feeling like ever since Matt Harvey got hurt in the beginning of 2013, we pointed to 2015, knowing when he would come back as a, you know, a timer to be on the Mets, for them to be ready by then. But I look at shortstop, and I look at all the question marks in this lineup and the Wheeler injury, and I think this isn't a finished product yet. How complete are the Mets, in your opinion?
Well, I want to touch on the shortstop thing really quick. I think Sandy's been getting a little too much pressure about the shortstop position. If you look around the league, not every team is fully complete at all eight positions on the field. So I think Wilmer can give us a good year. And even if he's, you know, one of the lower tier guys in the lineup, I still think he's going to be a solid contributor for us.
Well, I have to agree with you in the sense where, you know, whether or not Wilmer Flores hits, really, it isn't going to be the thing that makes the Mets season successful or unsuccessful. If David Wright's hitting and Lucas Duda's hitting and Travis d'Arnaud is hitting and Legarez can hit leadoff, then we're not really going to care so much if Wilmer Flores is just, you know, average in the field and average with the bat. So I will say that. But how would you grade, you know, your sort of optimism heading into the season? I sort of, like, feel like a cautious optimist. I want to be excited and I want to be hopeful, but there are a lot of unknown things, a lot of X factors, a lot of injury concerns where, you know, this team is supposed to make a run at the playoffs and they can contend for that, but I'm not quite sure if they're there.
Well, I would say when I did my predictions, I basically penciled the Nationals in as winning the NL East. I think their rotation is just too strong, and they got four with Desmond and Rendon. They got four or five, you know, legitimate all-star candidates in that lineup. So with that being said, I would still give the Mets a good chance. Now with the two wild cards, I give them a really good chance at that. Maybe if they can, you know, hover around the 86, 87 win mark, they'll be playing meaningful baseball in September.
Yeah, and that's really all Mets fans have asked for, is to be playing meaningful baseball through the summer and into September. You know, the Mets haven't had a finish above 500 since Citi Field opened in 2009. This is the seventh season, and the wall's being moved in for a second time. And really, the wait should be over. And you see, if you want to pencil in the Dodgers, Cardinals, and Nationals as champions of their respective divisions, then we're really looking at a competition with the Cubs, Pirates, Giants, Marlins, and the Mets. Would you agree with that, Brian? Those five teams, maybe, for those two wild card spots.
Another team I like is Cincinnati.
Cincinnati,
with
there you
Bruce,
go. Right.
Votto, Frazier. I think they got a good lineup. Cueto at the top and Chapman at the back end. I think they got a chance to compete.
So it's you know, I think it is fair to say that either the NL Central with four teams that are all pretty good, and I think the NL East even with like one team that's very good and two teams that are kind of good, are you know, those teams are going to beat up a lot on each other. And I'm curious to see how the NL Central definitely unfolds. But, Brian, we're going to flip over to basketball. And, you know, me and you are two huge college basketball guys. And it's ending, which is sad in a way, but it's also great because we're expecting the best three games of the season. Now, I'll tell everybody that me and you are in a pool together. And if Wisconsin and Duke make it to the finals, if Wisconsin wins, I win, and if Duke wins, you win. Is that right?
Correct, correct.
Okay, so
it's
we know what we're rooting for.
It wasn't a great bracket for me this year, but I'm clinging to that Duke team.
When you keep both teams that you have in the finals alive, it seems that you're always, you know, going to have a chance. The Final Four is mostly chalk, so if you felt good about one of those top teams, and you're here. But first, I'm going to go to Kentucky and Wisconsin first. And
okay.
The thing that me and you spoke about off air that I wanted to bring up was whether or not Notre Dame's ability to score, especially from the perimeter, created sort of a blueprint for how you have to beat Kentucky, and whether or not you think Wisconsin is one of the few teams that would be capable of doing that.
I definitely think, you know, Notre Dame, I don't want to say expose them, but, you know, definitely might have put that blueprint together. And Wisconsin and Notre Dame are different teams, but they can obviously both score the basketball with Kaminsky, Decker, you know, all those guys. I do give Wisconsin a legitimate chance to beat the Wildcats. I would say heading into the tournament, Wisconsin, Duke, I would have said potentially Arizona. Those were kind of my three, but obviously now Wisconsin and Duke are here, and I think, you know, whoever Kentucky – I still think Kentucky's still my favorite right now, but I think both of those teams can really give them a game. I think Duke especially really has the athletes to compete with Kentucky. You know, Quinn Cook, Tyus Jones, Winslow, they got – you know, kind of almost the same, you know, the top McDonald's All-Americans like Kentucky has. So I really like Duke and Wisconsin.
Well, doesn't it feel like Duke is almost pulling a Kentucky on Kentucky, going to the Final Four with this mostly, like, really young team? You got older guys like Quinn Cook sprinkled in, but it's really Justice Winslow and Jahlil Okafor that have and Tyus Jones that have made you feel like this Duke team has a chance to win the national championship, and that's normally what Kentucky's doing with what the Harrisons were last year. I don't think Kentucky's offense gets enough credit, and I know that that's something that I think that you would say also with their ability to score down the stretch, but we know that they suffocate defensively. Wisconsin's inside-out, you know, ability to score from the perimeter and inside with Kaminsky, they could give Kentucky a problem, and I wonder that if they're going to be able to, you know, stretch them out on the perimeter with the bigs, and whether or not, you know, Calipari has to bring in Trey Lyles, maybe more than he'd like. But something that actually you said to me was funny about how Kentucky's offense, though, could just give the ball to K.A. Towns whenever they need to and just go get a big bucket. Do you think that something like that's the difference in the game?
I think what we saw at the end of the Notre Dame game was, you know, I guess one of the knocks, if you will, against Kentucky is their offense hasn't been spectacular this year, but it did look at, like, at the end of that Notre Dame game, they really could just throw it into Towns whenever they want to get a bucket. And both of the Harrison twins, I'm not sure if it's Andrew or Aaron who hit multiple big shots in last year's tournament. I believe it was Aaron. But it looks like they can get it to one of those guys late in the game. I one of them hit a long three at the end of the Notre Dame game, and then one had the drive towards the end where he got fouled and hit the two shots that ended up winning the game.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, I think those guys and Towns, it seems like when they want to get that bucket, they can go and get it. So it's definitely going to come down to getting some late stops for Wisconsin. You know, if they win, it's going to be a tight one. It's going to be a grinded out battle.
Yeah, they appear to be beatable, but, you know, nobody's beatable until they actually get beaten. I know that people like to have these conversations about the greatest team of all time and all that, whatever. I don't want to compare errors, but all I know is that if you go 40-0, that's an all-time accomplishment. And when somebody beats Kentucky, I'll believe that somebody can beat Kentucky, basically. But what about the other game, Brian? You know, Michigan State's a team led by senior leadership and experience, whereas, like we said about Duke, they're really just a dominant force, you know, peppered with young guys. And Coach K making his 12th Final Four appearance, tying John Wooden for the most ever. You see this as a close one or a Duke rout or what?
I personally see this as I think Duke is going to win somewhat convincingly. You know, I think Michigan State has had a magical run this tournament. Don't want to take anything away from them. But I think when all is said and done on Saturday night, I think Duke is going to win pretty comfortably. I want to say, you know, they got an eight or nine point lead late, maybe some fouls, you know, it kind of blows it out a little bit. But I would say Duke by about 8 or 9 would be my guess.
Yeah, no disrespect to Michigan State. As I mentioned before, I had him in my Final Four. They've done things that, you know, many people thought that they couldn't, but you know what we got. It's Wisconsin and Duke for us, but you know, against our better judgment, because we know exactly what Kentucky is. Brian, my man, I appreciate you coming on with me. You're very, very insightful and articulate and knowledgeable. Thank you, bro.
No problem, bro. Anytime.
All right, we'll talk soon. And that was Brian. It's Brian from Queens. We got a couple Brians from Queens just having a chat. You know, I got a couple minutes left here, and I guess the only other thing left for me to talk about is my stats of the week. Now, Brian, you can hang with me here as long as you like, and you can chime in on the stats of the week.
I was going to hang on. You do your thing.
Okay, and I basically think I might just cut him off by mistake. I hope that I didn't. Stats of the week. Kentucky, who we were just speaking about, made their last 9 field goals. The last miss came with 12 minutes and 5 seconds on the clock. They were getting outplayed for a lot of that time. They kept making their shots, and they did enough to win. Because that's what great teams do. So when they lose, that's when I'll believe they can actually lose. And that's how I think everybody should look at it. Try to enjoy, even if you don't like Kentucky, I don't like Kentucky, I'm a St. John's fan. I went to UAlbany. Try to appreciate greatness when you're watching it. And Coach K, as I mentioned, more greatness. 12 Final Four. Another polarizing team in Duke. But record tying 12 Final Four. 27 Final Fours by these 4 coaches. Izzo with 7, Calipari with 6, Paul Ryan with 2. Calipari went to 2 with UMass. But that's amazing. So you see just the quality, the level of coaching that we have in this Final Four and between Saturday and Monday. It's a great way to close out the season, a great way to close out the college basketball season. My closing argument here would be Phil Jackson summing up the Knicks season by saying blank happens. You can imagine if you've ever seen Forrest Gump, you know, it happens. What? Blank? Sometimes. And, you know, he's right. That's all it was crap, a dumpster fire. And we all know that. And I think that Phil Jackson's message to season ticket holders and coming out and saying these things is him trying to wrap this up and put closure on it, because we all realize the truth. The truth is that Phil Jackson's job is only beginning. Phil Jackson's real job as GM and president of basketball operations begins now. It begins with the draft. It begins with free agency. This season was a throwaway. The Knicks are sitting in purgatory this season. But luckily, you know, Phil Jackson's here to try to pull him out of that. He's certainly getting paid enough to do as much. Don't judge Phil until after free agency. It's only right, and he's been catching, you know, the backhand of everybody's jokes. And you can best believe the legend don't like that. Special thanks to Brian from Queens. And anybody that may be listening, join us next week. Final Four this weekend. Check it out. St. John's with the legend coming home. Opening day on Monday. Mets and Yankees. New York Sports 30. You already know what it is. Give me that. Boom.